ॐ भरताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी। नात्यश्नलस्तु योगोऽस्ति यचैकान्तम् अनश्नुतः नचाति स्वप्नशीलस्य जागृतो नैव चार्जुन न अत्यश्नतः तु योगः अस्ति न च एकान्तम् अनश्नतः न च अतिस्वप्नशीलस्य जागृतः न एव च अर्जुन। To remember these previous verses, the last two verses especially, are really talking about that process of meditation. The verses before that are talking about sitting, how to sit, how to hold your mind, how to sit. And then once one is in that proper position where the body can be completely relaxed, you know, then they're talking about how to really pull the mind in and really sit with the Atma, sit with the Self, sit with the Self as Ishvara. So, and for such a one who's able to do that, that shanti that they realize is the shanti of the Self, is the peace of the Self. That's a shanti that's free of any type of dvaita. It's a shanti that's free of ashanti. Ashanti means that lack of peace. So the shanti was the shanti which is there, even with when ashanti is there. That's the shanti. That's the stability of the Self, of Brahman. And that stability is the nirvana paramam. That is actually moksha. That is actually liberation. Is the recognition of that Self which is inviolate, you know, and that Self. So it's, there's two things here: that shanti, which is Brahman, which is matsamstam. What does he say here? Yeah, matsamstam. That shanti, which is the abiding in me. So Krishna is talking as Ishvara, right? So it's the shanti that comes from the abiding in me. There's two things to understand here. One is the shanti, which is Brahman, the recognition of myself as Brahman, myself as the shanti, as that peace, that ananda, which is infinite. And also recognition, the abiding in me as Ishvara, in Krishna, abiding in Krishna as Ishvara. And so that's where the I and the whole comes in, right? It's not just a matter of the mind resolving into the Atma, resolving into the ananda or the wholeness or the fullness of the Self. It's the recognition that the fullness of the Self, the nature of Brahman, is this, that this whole Ishvara, that this whole Maya Upadi has for itself this Self. The Self which I am, which is the self which I am is the Self of Ishvara. And this creation is Ishvara, right? So it's the recognition that I am the whole. This body, said in a different way, this body, mind, sense organs that makes me an individual different from you is actually part and parcel of the whole. So if I recognize the whole as Ishvara, then this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishvara. That means that this jiva is part of a greater story. And that greater story, which is Ishvara, is who? I say this body is part of a greater story, is part of Ishvara. And who is Ishvara? Ishvara is myself. In other words, the Atma is the self of Ishvara. And so this Ishvara is not... Let me put it this way. I mean, this is a nice way to think of it. Ishvara, the Lord, the total manifest creation, is no less me. It is no less me than this body, mind, sense organs is me. For an Ajnani, for one who doesn't have self-knowledge, it's very easy, and almost it's natural, to take this body, mind, sense organs as me. Right? But when I recognize that this body, mind, sense organs that I have taken to be me, right, is actually part of a greater whole, and that myself actually is a sangha, has no particular attachment to this body, mind, sense organs, with or without the body, mind, sense organs, I am. And that this I that I am is in fact the self of the whole. That's the reality. So now, if that reality is understood, then as much as this body, mind, sense organs is me, this entire creation is me. But there's a difference in that this body, mind, sense organs is limited. The body is limited by space, the mind is limited by time and space, body by time and space, mind by time and space, sense organs by time and space. And the mind also is limited because being limited by time and space is limited in terms of its knowledge and in terms of its capacity, so limited knowledge. So this is a part to the whole. This is limited knowledge. The whole is limitless knowledge. This individual is me. The whole is me. But the whole is limitless knowledge. This individual is limited knowledge. See what I mean? And so if I recognize that both are equally me, right? Both are equally me because I am the self of both, then it gives me a more intimate relationship with the whole. I can't dismiss the whole as being other than me or inimical to me or against me, you know, or in judgment of me. All of these type of things are negated. They become a mitya. They become something illogical. And so I start to have a different kind of respect or intimacy or relationship with the whole. Because the whole is not foreign to me. It's as much me as this physical body. And you don't have a problem identifying with the physical body, right? You don't have a problem also with caring for the physical body and recognizes how the physical body works as a whole unit, in support of itself, keeping itself healthy, keeping itself whole, keeping itself in balance. It's an organism that's meant to do that, that's designed to do that. The whole creation is like that too. The whole creation is an infinite organism, an infinite manifestation of knowledge. You know? And that infinite manifestation of knowledge, this body, mind, sense organs, is a part of that. You know? So, in a way that in no way says that this body, mind, sense organs isn't subject to pain, that it's not subject to death, that it's not subject to all kinds of problems, just like the rest of the world is subject to death and all kinds of problems, right? And at least from our vantage point, subject to all kinds of disasters and problems and pains and sufferings. Now that, though, is the nature of the creation from the inside out. Like if you go into the jiva, into the body, mind, sense organs, it's full of change, it's full of birth and death, it's full of a constant disruption. Really. And all working for the health of the whole and working to correct itself, to cure itself all of the time. It's in that process. But say you take that process, you look at it just internally to your body and your mind, and then just extend it to the rest of the universe. That process is going on continually. And because of that, every part of the universe is in one sense, it's being eaten. You know, in fact, in the Katha Upanishad, it says death is like chutney. You know, the whole creation is in constant flux, and every part of it is being eaten. You know, being subject to death. Well, that's the nature of the creation, from every aspect of it, whether you're looking at your individual upadhi or the whole upadhi. So you're not going to escape that. You're not going to escape death. You're not going to escape illness. You're not going to escape all of the things that are part of samsara. You know, you're not going to escape calamity, so to speak. What is calamity for us? Well, you can say calamity is the loss of those things that we care about the most. That we call those things calamities. The loss of the things we care about the most. What are just losses? The loss of those things that we don't care very much about. We just don't call it a calamity. But the thing is that it's still lost. Because there isn't anything that isn't. So that's the nature of the creation. That's why all of these religions or spiritual disciplines always talk about asangaha or non-clinging, you know? Because the more you cling to anything in the creation, the less vairagya or dispassion, the less clinging there is, the better off you are. The more clinging, the more hurtful it is. And the reason it's hurtful is because you can't escape the nature of the creation. The nature of the creation is that everything is changing and in flux. So the more you hang on, the more you're going to be squashed and pained. So the question is for the mumukshu, is all the one who desires liberation, is the one who has kind of realized that this constant churning, the constant churning that belongs to the very nature of the creation, is there's no way to get out of that. And it's not that it's evil or against me. It's that every part of the creation, including the body, the mind, the sense organs, and everything that I perceive, has that as its guna, as its characteristic. And so if that's the truth of everything that I experience, including the body, mind, sense organs that I take to be me, there is no way to ward off calamity or the loss of what is most dear to me, because there's nothing that can survive the nature of the creation itself. That's the problem. And so when a person becomes a mumukshu, they are realizing that there is no way out of this in terms of, from the standpoint of my own means of knowledge, because I'm part of it. Right? Everything that makes you as an individual is part of the problem. You also are, every part of you is also bound by the same nature. And so you can't change that nature. And so then you realize bondage, because you don't have a solution to this problem. Because what we seek is something that where we can relax, where you can say, it's kind of the birthright of the, what every human being wants is to be able to just say, all is well with me, and not for the next 10 minutes. You know, all is well with me, and I can relax in that. And then relaxing in that space that is not subject to death, not subject to that change, then from that vantage point, I can experience the creation. And so that's why they say here in this verse that shanti, which is nirvanam param, that shanti which itself is moksha, it is liberation. Because that shanti, the nature of Brahman, is free from death, is free from change, and is the very being, is the very self of this creation, the very being of this creation. So that brings in the whole satyam mitya, that this self is the very being of this creation. And this creation becomes a manifestation of knowledge. It becomes Ishwara that has this creation that is totally bound by change, has for its being a self which is not bound by change. Has for its truth a self that is not bound by change. Now, when the self, when the being that the creation has is not bound by change, then change is taking place continually in the changeless. Because the self, the very being of what is changing, is changeless. That's the shanti. That is the moksha. Because then I realize that all of this change is what we call is mitya. All of this change that is taking place is not changing me. All of the change that is taking place is not harming me. And I see that all of the change that is taking place as part of a whole picture of which this body, mind, sense organs is a part. And that whole picture has the self, which is me, as its being. And so the jnani is the one who has recognized this, that recognized that no experience that I'm having is away from myself. And so in this section, they're talking about now the person who has this jnanam, the person who's gained this jnanam, gained this knowledge through contemplation, through knowledge through the pramana, and then has gotten rid of a lot of the samskaras, a lot of the pratibandhakas, the obstructions, the agitations and the obstructions and kind of the subtle likes and dislikes, all of the things that cause the mind to be to as though cover over my knowledge. So he's gone through all of this teaching about this meditation, these different types of meditation and how to observe the mind and all of that. And now, finally, after having said all of that, he's just saying, he's laying down some guidelines for the yogi, for the one who is meditating. Because should you want to be able to gain this nishta and to be really able to have the mind, you know, become kind of awake to yourself, to own yourself. Say you want to do nididhyasana, you want to do contemplation. He's giving a few guidelines. So what he says here is, he says there is no yoga for somebody who eats too much. You can't meditate. It's very difficult to meditate if you overeat. Because if you're too, this ati eshnata, for the one who's eating too much, because if you're full, you're first of all, you're not physically comfortable. And second of all, you become sleepy. And so it's actually, it's wonderful that the Gita will do, it gives a statement of the obvious. Okay? You've eaten too much, it makes you feel physically uncomfortable, you become sleepy. It's about the last thing you want to do is sit and meditate. What you want to do is lie down and sleep, or else take a walk or something to work off that being too full. And so, what does it mean to not eat too much? One thing that they say in the tradition is your stomach, if we want to just outline it for you, half of your stomach should be filled with food. You fill half the stomach with food. Fill the next quarter of the stomach with liquid and leave a quarter empty. If you can do that, then your stomach is not full, it's not stretched, there's still some space in there, and so that would be an appropriate amount. So then what's another thing you can think about? Well, when you want to take that next helping, don't. When you know, you've had enough, you'd like to take the next helping, you know that it's too much, don't take it. Yeah, those little disciplines, those are the little tricks of the trade. You know? So don't overeat if you want to do contemplation, because you won't be able to do it. Use a sense of proportion. Okay. What's the next thing? Nacha aikantam ashnataha. And also the one who doesn't eat at all. One who eats too much is a problem. One who doesn't eat at all is a problem. Because you don't have any energy, or you're thinking about food. If you fasted for a few days, you can go on for a while, but say you don't eat and you don't eat and don't eat and don't eat. Then you become weak. also in that situation also, your body isn't really assisting you in that meditation. And so really, in just in, now in these two lines, then this first line, it's really just common sense. It's nothing that you don't know. It's just telling you to have a sense of proportion around food. That's all. Just have a sense of proportion around food. Don't stuff yourself. Don't starve yourself. Then, what's next? Nacha atiswapnashilasya. Also, there's no yoga. There's no meditation for the one who sleeps too much. Atiswapna. Person sleeps all the time and sleeps all the time. Say, you sleep, say, too much during the day. What happens when you finally get up? You feel tired and you want to sleep some more. So too much sleep leads to too much sleep. Okay? So, what else? Jagrataha naivacha arjunaha. And also, for the one who's always awake. Who sleeps all the time, they need to sleep more. Doesn't sleep, doesn't get any sleep, they need to sleep. So too much sleep makes you sleepy. Too little sleep makes you sleepy. So all of it so far, we're going to have another verse of this too. All of this is just very simply sense of proportion. Get the amount of sleep that your body needs. Whatever the sleep is that your body needs, have that sleep. If you feel like you're sleeping when you're sleeping excessively, you know you're sleeping excessively and you don't feel good about it. Right? When you're not sleeping enough, you know you're not sleeping enough and you're exhausted and all you want to do is get some sleep. And so just to be cognizant, to be normal, to bring your life into a sense of proportion. So you have a proportion, sense of proportion over what you eat and what you sleep. And there's not a lot more to it than that. It's just being normal. Now, let's look at the next one. Yukta-hara-viharasya Yukta-cheshtasya-karmasu Yukta-cheshtasya-karmasu Yukta-swapna-vabodhasya Yukta-swapna-vabodhasya Yoga-pavati-dukkaha Yoga-pavati-dukkaha Yukta-ahara-viharasya Yukta-cheshtasya-karmasu Yukta swapna avabodhasya yogaha bhavati dukkaha. Shankara says in his introduction, well, what again is this yoga? How does it take place? So he says, for the one who has, yukta means that which is proper or suitable. Or Swamiji uses a sense of a proportion. So for the one who's ahara, who's eating, and vihara, their activity. Eating is the what they eat. The vihara is any type of activity, really. So for the one who's eating and their activities are yukta, are proportionate, are appropriate. They have a sense of proportion. And yukta chetasya karmasu. And this is interesting. In one's karmas, karmas means your duties, the things that are enjoined upon you to do, your responsibilities. The one whose actions, whose cheshta, whose movements, whose activity is yukta. So that what you choose to do, how do you view your responsibilities? So that you don't become obsessive. In terms of your responsibilities. Your responsibilities, also you have a sense of proportion. The one thing that brings me to mind, and I think Swamiji has talked about this in different ways, is the thing I often remember with him is because of his position, he has so many things going on in India, so many people, that his to-do list in his stack, you know, is really on his desk. It's way high, you know, and the to-do list is way more than could can possibly be done. And so how do you approach your life when there's more to do than you can do? Right? So for him, this is his attitude. Every day, I just do as much as I can. You know, it's not about clearing off the desk. It's not about doing what can't be done. It's about doing what I can comfortably do without being lazy. It's not about being lazy either. It's just about doing what is there to be done to the best of my ability. And I just do what I can do, and then the rest of it has to wait. It's really interesting, especially when the rest of it that has to wait is as important as the stuff that what you did get done today. It's not like the other stuff is any less important. But the problem is that there's only so many hours in a day, and so the stuff that is very important that you didn't get done actually has to be put off until the next day because there's no choice in it, right? And so then that's a really clean attitude. I do as much as I can in a given day. And then the rest has to wait until the next day because I've done as much as I can. Another attitude that is similar to this is say you have many people who are asking you for money. Like, for instance, if Swamiji goes into Manjikuti, his hometown, people will be waiting for him to come, and they'll be lined up all the way down the street to see him. But there'll be the villagers will come to ask for help because they need help. There's many people in this country too, but in India there's many people that don't have anything. They don't have money. They don't have enough money to send their child to school. They don't have enough money to eat. They don't have enough money, period. They don't, and their needs are very real, or they're ill. There's so many different things. And so then when the person comes to you to ask, what do you do? What do you do in that situation, especially when they're lined up all down the street? And Swamiji just said, I give as much as I can, and then when there's nothing to give, I don't give it. There's a sense of proportion, really. You give what you can, because we all want to give. You give what you can, and then when there's nothing there to give, then you can't give that. It sounds so obvious, but there's something very simple and clean. You know, if you have the money to give, if you have what it is, if you have the ability to help, then of course you help. But if you don't have the ability to help, or there's no other way, nothing more to give, then you say, I'm sorry, I don't have that right now. It's very, very simple, you know. And so here, so that's on one level. Another level is your own obsessiveness around what you think needs to be done. Trying to do more, or worrying too much about what you need to do or what you need to accomplish. Not allowing yourself just to simply be with the situation and do your best. There's a whole overlay that can of obsessiveness that can come on. And so he talks about that also, to avoid the obsessive behavior around your responsibilities. You don't usually really necessarily think about that, you know. To avoid the obsessive behavior around your responsibilities means what? Just to do the best that you can. So, then what? Then, so the one who has that type of sense of proportion toward their life, basically, you have a sense of proportion toward your life, then Yukti Swapna of Abodasya, and the one who has gotten it together in terms of their waking and sleeping. So that has a sense of proportion for that. For that person, yoga or contemplation or recognition of the self is bhavati dukkha, is something that really destroys dukkha, sorrow. Ha comes from hun, to kill or destroy. Then for such a person who his life has a sense of proportion or in reference to their life, not excessive, you know, and not depriving either, So for that person, this yoga is something which is destroys the sorrow. Yeah. So now let's do this next verse. Yada viniyatam chittam, yada viniyatam chittam, atmanyeva vatishtate, atmanyeva vatishtate, nispraha sarva kamebhyaha, nispraha sarva kamebhyaha, yukta ityuchate tada,
yukta ityuchate tada,
yada viniyatam chittam, atmani eva avatishtate, nispraha sarva kamebhyaha, yukta iti uchate, yuktaha iti uchate tada. Now he's shifting gears a little bit. He's taught all that is necessary really for gaining this knowledge and for having nishta in it. Now he's talking about the person who does have nishta, who is rooted in this knowledge. Having given, he's gone through all of the karma, he's given the knowledge, gone through so much karma yoga, taught all of these meditation techniques, how to do it and all of these things, and who to do it, how to keep your mind, how to live your life. Then what about the one who has accomplished all of this? He says, yada, when, viniyatam chittam, the mind, chittam is the mind, which is viniyatam. Viniyatam means it has a single-pointedness, a focus. It's a focused mind. It's a controlled mind, not controlled like this, but just naturally it's a focused mind. That mind, avatishtate, it sits in, it rests in atmani, in the self. Atmani avatishtate. Such of that mind, that's a product of all that's gone before, that mind rests naturally in the self. Atmani avatishtate. Nispraha karma sarvakamebhyaha. Being nispraha, completely free from desire. For sarvakamebhyaha, all of the objects of desire, the one who has no attachment for them. Nispraha means a free from the desire for these objects of desire. Free of attachment for any of the kama. Kama can mean either the desire or the object of desire. So here, because there's no desire for all of these objects, so sarvakamebhyaha, from all of these desires, nispraha, the one from whom that attachment is gone, then that person is called a yuktaha. That person is one who's mature in this knowledge. Okay? So, what does it mean here? So they're going to give an example in the next verse of what this is. What does it mean for the mind to sit in the self or to abide in the self? How does the mind abide in the self? That's like saying, how does the wave abide in the water? Really? It's in the ocean, right? There's waves in the ocean. The truth of the wave is the water. How does the wave abide in the water? Only by recognizing I am water. That's the only way. Right? Because otherwise, what does it mean? The wave is water. But the wave doesn't know it's water. Right? It thinks it's one of many waves as part of the ocean. It doesn't recognize its being. It doesn't mean it's not that being is not there. So for my mind, I am Brahman. But the mind only recognizes the self as itself. Right? The satya mitya is this. The mind is the self, but the self is free of the mind. All the mind recognizes for the ajnani, the one who doesn't have knowledge, is that I, the mind, am the self. I, the mind, am the conscious being. That means that the conscious being is always changing. If I, the mind, am the conscious being, then the conscious being is sometimes agitated, sometimes angry, sometimes happy, sometimes ecstatic, sometimes dull, sometimes bored. So whatever the condition of the mind is, then that's the condition of me. Because the other half of the satya mitya isn't understood, and that is, the mind is me, But I am not the mind. It's like saying the wave is the water. Because there is nothing but water. But the water is free of the wave. So I need to recognize, to recognize the, for the mind to say I am abiding in the self means that I am awake. I have recognized myself as being changeless. I have recognized that the self of the mind, upon which the mind is totally dependent, is itself completely free of the mind. The mind, which is continually changing and continually going through one state of state into the next state, to the next state, to the next state, that all of those states are taking place and have for their self changeless me. Right? The mind has to recognize that fact, because the mind already is abiding in the self. Literally, right? That's already the truth. So how can you say that? How can the mind abide in the self? The mind is, you know, there it's not abiding anyplace else. So that abiding is only solely that recognition of that satyam nitya, the recognition of the changelessness of myself. And so when the mind, which is, they say, focused, and now focused means, this is, Shankara uses a word here. He says for viniyatam, it's a particular type of ekagratam. Ekagratam means a single-pointedness where the mind itself never doesn't recognize the self. And that also is not a big deal. That's to think of it like this. Once the wave recognizes the water, is it hard for the wave to continue recognizing the water? Right? Because there is never a time that the wave has any distance whatsoever from the water. There is never, we can say like this, there is never a time when the wave is not the water. Right? There is never a time when my mind is not the Atma, is not consciousness. Every part of the mind is only consciousness, like every part of the wave is only water. Every part of the mind, every vritti I have, is only the Atma. So there's only one little shift. The little shift is that the mind has to recognize that the self, which it is changeless. That the changing mind has for itself a changeless self, has for its being a changeless being. Now, that also is not difficult to recognize, because it's the reality. It's the reality that the mind is itself always changing, and that the consciousness which the mind enjoys is never changing. That's the reality, right? Because even for an ajnani, for somebody that doesn't have knowledge, I am, I am, I am, I am, every vritti I have, every thought modification I know, every experience, I exist, my existence doesn't change as the mind goes on changing. The I am doesn't all of a sudden go away. So all of the change in mind takes place in me who continue to exist. And every thought modification that I have is known. So I illumine, I am the conscious being that illumines all of these thought modifications that come and go. That's my experience. It just needs to be pointed out. Nobody's going to say, oh no, that's not true. You know, people instead will say something like, how could I have not seen that? Because it's an obvious thing. It is obvious that you are there, present, to every thought that comes and goes. It's obvious that the thoughts come and go, and it's obvious that you are there, constant, to those thoughts as they come and go. So that's the end by Vyatireka. When the thought is, I am, but the Vyatireka breaks down. When the thought is not, I still am. Mm-hmm. That means I'm changeless. Mm-hmm. In reference to the thought, I'm changeless. Mm-hmm. Because I haven't left when the thought leaves. So this is something to discern. This is actually pointing out the reality of my experience. And so when it's pointed out, then because that relationship, the satya-mitya relationship, never changes no matter what the thought is, no matter what the emotion is, once I see it, it's actually hard not to see it. Right? Once I get it, it's hard not to get it. Even when the mind can be acting up, the mind can be acting up, causing pain, reacting, getting angry, because it hasn't had a chance to work through all this, can be acting up. But it's acting up in me, who am remaining the same. So once a person recognizes that, you know, it's hard not to recognize it, is what I'm saying. And so here, the mind, which has seen it, has recognized that, that mind abides in the Atma. Now what does it say? And now, when the Atma, as the mind has settled down, this is what they mean by the Vinayatam, this mind which has settled down, which has become single-pointed, which is, abides in the self, for that mind, there is no desire for objects of desire. For all of these objects of desire, there's any desire for them would be mitya. The reason is that the ananda that we were seeking in the object, we already have. Right? If you already feel whole and complete, then you're not seeking to become whole and complete. It's simple. Any of the desires that you have, I want to do this and I want to do that, that's fine. Those are mitya desires, because you're the Dr. Bija desires, the burnt seed desires, because your ananda is not dependent, your well-being is not dependent on the fulfilling of the desire. Happily, you want to do that. It's not as an unhappy person, I want to do that so I can become happy. That's the difference, you know. And so when they say, you know, there is no desire for all of these objects of desire, means I don't need them in order to be whole. You have to be careful there, because you don't want to, it's not to say that as long as you have the prarabdha karma, the karmas that have caused you to take this birth, that you're not going to want to do this or want to do that, otherwise you would never move. You'd never move. But your ananda is not at stake. That's the thing. The mind itself is sitting in the ananda. Right? It's like the wave sitting in the water. The mind itself is sitting in the ananda and awake to it. Now, another problem. Ananda. Ananda is always translated as bliss. That is a problem. Because ananda doesn't mean, the swarupa ananda of the self is not a bliss that comes and goes, and it's not a bliss that's hidden from you sometimes. Like, you think, this is when Swamiji's always making fun. No? You know, I understand this knowledge of making fun of us. I understand this knowledge, Swamiji, you know, but I'm still not happy. I still, you know, I don't have the bliss. I still don't have the bliss, Swamiji. But, you know, he's making fun to make us see. Because the thing is, if you don't have the bliss, then that bliss is something that comes and goes because you don't have it. Right? That means it comes and goes. If it can come and go, right, then that's a state of mind. That's a vritti. That's a thought modification. So what you should say then is, Swamiji, you know, I don't have the thought modification of bliss. That type of, I don't have the bliss thoughts. I don't have the bliss thoughts, you know, and I have dukkha vrittis. I have sorrowful thoughts. I don't have bliss thoughts. But then the question is, who are you? What is the Shanti? Who are you, you know, that's illumining these bliss thoughts or illumining these dukkha vrittis? Who are you? What is your nature? The one that doesn't come and go. That's the ananda that we're talking about. That's the ananda that you have to wake up to. That's an ananda that is not being covered by your sorrowful vrittis or your happy vrittis. So that's the ananda that the mind recognizes, and that's the ananda that the mind revels in and becomes attached to. It's the ananda that is already present, the ananda that is not covered by your variety of vrittis. Now, on another level, the variety of vrittis means thought modifications. The variety of thoughts, the variety of emotions, you know, are painful, just like a broken leg is painful, right? Or a sick body is painful. A hurt mind is painful, right? And so we want to do things and have attitudes, proper attitudes and all of that, karma yoga attitudes, and things that settle down the mind. That's true, right? But the Atma doesn't need to be settled down. The Atma doesn't need to be made full or made whole or made blissful or made complete. It already is that. That has to be recognized. Okay. When that is recognized, when the mind recognizes that the source of ananda that it seeks is the self, now that mind is different. Mm-hmm. It is different because it's no longer seeking ananda, thinking that it's out here. And how far away is the ananda from the mind? How far away is the ananda of the self, the nature of the self, from the mind? There's no distance, just like wave and water. And so what happens is the mind now relaxes and settles into an ananda, or the wholeness of my being, which is steady. And so now the mind is no longer, loses its it's no longer a seeker. It's no longer a seeker. It's no longer seeking to become happy, seeking to become whole, seeking to become full, seeking to get the right combination of things so I can say that all is well with me. That seeking stops. Now all is well with me. The mind rests there at home. And then what to do with this world then? All is well with me, now what? Okay. What to do with the world? The world is Ishvara. It is the world that you live is your prarabdha. And so your life will live itself out. And there's all kinds of things to do, whatever the prarabdha means the karmas that brought you into this life, and will take you all the way through. Those karmas will continue to unfold, and it's very exciting. You engage in Ishvara, you engage in the life which is part of Ishvara. And you engage and engage and engage and engage and engage, and that's the life. And you engage not out of ananda, not for ananda. And so that's the nature. He says the person for whom that is the reality, that person is called a yuktaha, one who is mature in this knowledge. So he gives an example, a student's example, so we don't have to go through all of this next week.
Yata dipo nivatastaha, nengate sopama smita, nengate sopama smita, yogino yata chittasya, yunjato yogamatmanaha, yunjato yogamatmanaha.
Now he describes yata dipaha nivatastaha na ingate sa upama sprita yoginaha yata chittasya yunjataha yogam atmanaha. Now he gives an example. It's called an upama. An upama is an illustration. He gives an illustration. What is the mind of a yogi like, of somebody who has knowledge, who has nishtha? What is their mind like? And so now they wanted to give some sort of an example of that. So he says, just as a lamp, a light, a deepa, like this, a light here, just like a deepa, a lamp, which is nivatastaha, which is abiding in a place free of any wind, just like a little light lamp that's abiding in a place that's free of any wind, na ingate, it doesn't tremble or waver at all. It is just steady. It is just still, right? It's not wavering. Sa upama sprita. That example, that is an upama. That is an example that is told, smrita, for a yogi whose mind is under control, yoginaha, for a yogi, who has yata chittasya, whose mind is is held in their hands.
Who is Yunjataha, who is doing yoga, who is practicing meditation on the self, so it says.
It's meditation on the self. What is that mind like? That mind is like the flame of a candle in a windless place. Now, Swamiji does something nice with this. How a flame is actually, continually moving. Right? A flame is just, because it's burning the oil. So it's actually flame, 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 flame. It's not constant. But in a windless place, it's absolutely still. It's not trembling at all. And so like that, the mind of a jnani has a stillness, even though there's vrittis, like thought after thought after thought, there's engagement in the world, so there's many, many thought modifications. All of the thought modifications that you would have to have in order to think or to do vyavahara, to engage in the world. Many, many thoughts. So it's not that there's no thought. It's just that the thoughts are not agitated. The thoughts are steady. They're clean. They're not agitated. They're not trembling. And so that mind, in spite of engaging in the world, is very still. It's very much at peace, even though there's thought after thought after thought after thought. The thoughts aren't in a state of agitation. And that is the mind of a jnani. Here it says, for that yogi who's practicing contemplation on the self. But for somebody with jnana nishtha, you're no longer contemplating on the self. You are the self. Swamiji addresses this also. You start by before mumukshu, and when you're gaining knowledge, you contemplate on the self so the mind can recognize and differentiate over and over again, as long as necessary, the self from itself, because the mind is always totally engaged in all of its own activities, its own emotions, its own problems. It never recognizes the very self that is itself. It doesn't differentiate. So when the mind is brought to a state of equipoise, a state of calm, and then come into relationship, it sounds silly, but it's like the wave coming into relationship with the water, recognizing that which is its own being. This mind has to come into relationship with my being, even though my being is it. Right? My being, there's no distance between me and the mind. But the mind hasn't recognized me as being something, the satyam of itself, the truth of itself. It's identified itself with me, which means I take on all of its problems. Right? All of its hurts, all of its pains, all of its agitations become me from the standpoint of the mind, rather than the mind recognizing, the truth of itself as being changed, the changelessness of my being. And so, once the mind knows that, then who am I? Like you ask the wave, who are you? The jnani wave is going to say, I'm water. Because who is it, really? It is water. But the water is different than the wave. Right? So who am I? But the mind says, who am I? I am the Atma. I am the self. I recognize myself. There's nowhere that the mind can go, right? There's nowhere that the thoughts can go, the emotions can go, the perceptions can go. That is not me. I am always there, and I'm always there in exactly the same way. For me, there is no wavering at all, right? Because the self is shanti, it's completely still. For the mind that has recognized the self, which is itself, there's no wavering. It's like a still candle flame. No matter what the thoughts are, what the perceptions are, all of those perceptions are taking place in that which is absolutely stable. And so that mind is a completely relaxed mind. It's a completely stable mind, no matter how many vrittis that are there. So as Swamiji was saying, like with a candle flame, how many flames are there? I mean, it's taking place so quickly. You know, it's the illusion of a single flame there. It's actually flame, 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 flame. But without it, there's no wind there. There's no movement. And so like that, for Jnani, there's so much going on as you engage in the world. But there's that stillness. It's also the stillness and the strength of the mind. And so that's the mind of a yogi who who is practicing this meditation on the self. And Swamiji takes it further to just the recognition that the one who has knowledge isn't meditating, or another way to say it is never not meditating. You can say they're not meditating because they're not ever not meditating. And then what do you mean by meditate? Meditate is just a recognition of yourself. If you know yourself, when are you not recognizing yourself? If you know yourself, the mind has given up, it has matured in the sense that the mind isn't taking you off for a ride here and there, looking for your ananda, so that knowledge is firm, then there's no time that you're not meditating, right? Because you're always awake to yourself. So that's another way to say it, to make sense to everybody. Okay, let's stop here.
Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Seems like there's a stillness in that flame, or is it just...
It's still.
Yeah.
Because there's no wind.
The illustration, Carol, how do you interpret that? Is that a matter of psychodynamics? I mean, the mind being still, is that the body being... focused on, I mean, what does that mean? Because you have all these vrittis, and then there's that, how do you explain
there's
that
no,
stillness that you're referring
to? No agitation. It's like your mind can be very engaged in the world, but still feel still.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be very engaged in the world and feel very agitated, or upset, or all of these type of things. So, you can notice it yourself when your mind is just neutral and at peace. You can be very, very engaged, but you still feel still. Right?
So it just means lack of agitation.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's what it means. Yeah. The winds of agitation. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, sometimes you can get upset, and that stillness wavers, or...
Usually when you're upset, you don't feel very still.
No, no.
The wind's blowing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then when that calms, you can see that stillness again, or notice the stillness again, easily, you know.
Yeah, I think what they're talking is that the, you know, when you don't ask the world to be different, it's in other words, this I need this to be happy, and that can be on very subtle levels and on very kind of gross and big levels, but it always comes down to I need this to be happy, and as soon as that's there, there's some tension, right? When it's not there, then the mind is engaged, but it's quiet. It's at peace. And so there comes a time when, and you can probably see your own maturation process in this, where you're asking less and less of the world, that you have to be like this in order for me to be happy. And it's because your mind is enjoying the shanti or the peace of your own being. So as it feels itself more and more full, it asks less and less of the world. When it knows that the source of the fullness is your own being, and all of these kind of samskaras or tendencies, old patterns based upon ajnanam are dropping off, and your mind is more and more just enjoying the fullness of yourself, it doesn't ask the world. When it doesn't ask the world to be in a certain way, then you can simply be present with stillness. It's not that you're trying to be still. It's that stillness is your normal condition. Peace is your normal condition without the ignorance. Right? Because you have to think about what makes you agitated. Well, you want something to be different. It's so simple. Just ask yourself, next time you're really agitated, just say, okay, I want something to be different. What is that? You know, what is it that I'm looking for here? That's always a nice question, you know, because it brings your knowledge home.
So when you do get swept away, you shouldn't right away try to look for the stillness of my being, or...
Yeah, that's nice to do also. When you get swept away, the stillness of your being is right there, you know, with the storm. It's not away.
Yeah.
So in fact, it's nice to pull your mind back into that, because you're there. The stillness is there.
Mm.
So when you're feeling swept away, you can just, you know, pull the mind back, so to speak. To recognize that,
and you still stay swept away, but you can.
You say your mind, you still stay swept away in the sense that your mind may be feeling agitated, but you're pulling it back to recognize what isn't swept away. You can be swept away; the mind can be swept away, but you're not going to be swept away.
Right.
And so you can recognize that, and then that'll settle down. You know, the mind's not like it's not like a physical wave. The mind is not really physical, it's subtle. That's one of the great things about it. You can change the mind. You don't have to physically get in, you know, with your saws and all that. You don't have to physically do anything to change the mind. Your attitude can change the mind. Bringing your knowledge to the mind can change it, you know. Talking to the mind, if you're dealing with unconscious material or traumatic material, that's a little bit different because there's a lot of affect in that, you know. But then you can change that also by kindness, by having an attitude toward that affect or that hurt part of yourself, that hurt child, that is caring and loving and wants to help. You know, just like if you had a child who was very upset, you can either make that child much more upset, you know, by being mean, or, oh, for God's sake, get to your room, you know, or some other horrible thing that can be said, you know, and make the situation so much worse, so much more painful. Or you can be loving and want to help. That's an attitude. With that attitude, then that our pain transforms itself. It transforms itself when there's love and care there. And when there's hatred or more criticism there, it doesn't transform itself. It digs itself into a deeper hole. So more pain. You know, and so say you learn all of these things. You know these. You have this knowledge. And you understand it in light of your self-knowledge. You understand the psychological knowledge in the light of your self-knowledge. Then you know how to help the mind when it's in trouble. The buddhi, you know, your knowledge knows how to come to the aid of all of the parts of the mind that are hurt or in trouble to relieve it of its pain. Or if it's on not on this kind of traumatic or unconscious level, it just has to do with kind of a self-forgetfulness of I want this to be so that I can be happy. Then you can say, no, it's okay. You don't really need it. You do your best, but do it out of happiness, not for happiness. Bring your knowledge back. That's all. Bring your knowledge back into it, is all I'm saying. Recognize the fact of it. I don't mean that as like a cliche, do that. It's okay. You're the one who's happy. That's not it. You have to recognize the fact of it. The ananda of yourself that is there. And bring the mind back to that. Bring it home. Get used to bringing it home. And after a while, it doesn't want to leave. It's not worth it. Because you're leaving, say you're leaving home. You're going out into the storm of where by nature, by the very nature of the storm, by the very nature of the creation, it is going to change and change and change and change. And so you're putting yourself at risk in a very silly way once you know. It's better to be with all of these situations as Ishwara. Be with the situation, but not say, I need the situation to be a particular way. Instead, you be with the situation as it is, as Ishwara, and do your best in it to be helpful. So Swamiji said that many times. It's like you be with the situation and be with it, be helpful, whatever way that is. But it's different if you're, instead of being with the situation, you need to manipulate the situation so that you can be happy. That is so extremely stressful when you think about it, you know.
What do you mean by that? Control?
Well, you control it. Like, say, you're instead of being with the situation and trying to be helpful, because your ananda is not at stake, you're not with the situation. You're trying to control the situation and change the situation so that it can behave in such a way to make you happy. And that is stressful. Because even if you can pull that off, then you have to, say you do pull it off and you do get what you want out of the situation, trying to control it. And the problem is now, for the moment, you have what you want, but then how are you going to keep it there? Because it's not going to stop moving. You know, you've set it in one direction, it'll just keep going, and pretty soon it will have moved beyond, you know, your comfort level again. So then what do you have to do? You have to go and control it some more. You know? It's awful. Now, if that were really the nature, and it doesn't work, of course, but if that were the nature of the creation, then there would be no such thing as liberation. We would all just be running after trying to control things to try to create some happiness for ourselves. But if that's not the nature of the situation, nature of the creation, then we're doing that, beating our head against the wall because it doesn't ever work, because that's not the nature of the creation. And it's not where the ananda is located. And so we're running around trying to do all of this control, and it never works, except for little moments. But those moments are surrounded by dukkha, surrounded by suffering, because the moments go away by the very nature of the creation. And when in reality that whole time, the ananda that we're seeking is the self, you know? And so when the mind recognizes that, it gives up this beating its head against the wall, which is causing a lot of pain in the mind. Right? So it gives that up, so it's giving up the pain, and then what is my natural condition? Is wholeness, is fullness. That is me, that's my natural condition. You know? And so then the mind relaxes more and more into the natural condition of my being, and then it gets attached to being there. And that is safe. That attachment, that is the one safe attachment. And it's safe because the self is changeless. It's not going to run away. It's not going to say, oh, you're attached to me. What are we going to do about that? It won't ever do anything. It's absolutely secure. But that's the only thing that is secure. What is changeless is secure. The world is not secure. So if we ask it to be secure, we become more and more secure in that, insecure in that asking. Because you're asking something that's not secure by its nature to be secure, and then that makes you really insecure. Right? It doesn't work. And we all know it. So even though we do ask for it, we feel insecure underneath the asking for it.
Because it's not there.
And then the whole first part of the Vedas, yeah, because it doesn't exist, but the first part of the Vedas teaches you, all right, that's the truth of it. Everything is constantly changing, but how to make the best of it? Not looking at knowledge, not from the standpoint of the self, and that is Dharma. By Dharma, the following Dharma, Dharma is once removed from let me have this so that I can be happy. Then that's the most insecure. Let me have this so I can be happy, where I'm trying to fulfill my desires with sense objects. But with Dharma, the practice of Dharma, there's an attitude which is more like, let all my actions be dharmic so that I can be happy. Because you recognize that it's only really through Dharma that the mind can enjoy any type of relatively long-lasting chanti. Because it's not attached to objects, it's attached to behavior that is harmonious with Ishwara. Behavior that is harmonious with the nature of the creation. You know, the basic Dharma really is the golden rule, even in India and all over. Do unto others as you would have done to yourself. And they say, and don't do to others what you wouldn't have done to yourself. That's kind of the overarching Dharma. And then there's a lot of specific, you know, things. Ahimsa is another overarching Dharma, non-injury. You know? But then sometimes what is actually dharmic in a situation is difficult to know.
But that too is for a samsari, right?
Yeah, but it's for a samsari. But Dharma is something that's natural for a jnani. Dharma is what is natural for a person. Person is naturally good, naturally caring, naturally loving, naturally wanting to help, you know, naturally saintly. Actually, what we consider saintly, and we saintly, I don't mean in a goo-goo way, I mean in a solid way. A saintly person, that everybody would consider a saintly person, that is really your nature. That's what you. That's why you hold it in such high esteem, because that is really who you are, and you are saintly. All of us are saintly in our behavior spontaneously when there's not a problem there. A problem like, I want this so that I can be happy type of a problem that gets in the way of my goodness. Because we're all seeking happiness, you know, because of ignorance. And so that seeking, when a desire comes up, that desire can cause my behavior to become adharmic. Because I want the wholeness, I want the happiness, and I seem to have lost it. As soon as I project it onto an object, it's as though it's now out there. And I have to go get it back. And sometimes I have to get it back. I really must get it back, and sometimes I have to hurt others to get it back. but I want it so badly that I will do that. It will hurt others for it. But what if I don't? What if it's not gone? Then there's no such impetus. And so even for every person...
But if it's not gone from a different perspective, right? Because physically...
It's never gone, really. But even for a jnani, or even for you, you means anybody who doesn't have nishta, many times it's not... There's no conflict. You're at peace. There's nothing at the moment you particularly want. You feel fine. You know? When you're in that state, there's nothing that's you need in order to be happy at the moment. Then you're generous. Your behavior is generous. It's not harmful. Because that's what's natural. You know, that you're naturally good person. Everybody is. Because then your nature is the Atma. It's the self, which is Ananda. That is who you are. You know. So we're just the ajnanam, the ignorance, causes so many problems, you know, and so much adharmic behavior and all of that. But a person who realizes, even without having self-knowledge, that it is through dharma that I gain the most shanti. And we learn that through experience also. Like the guilt you feel if you hurt somebody, you know, or the if you tell a lie, all of these things, then the kind of agitation that causes, or if you steal or do any of these things that are considered adharmic. They're considered adharmic because they create agitation in the mind. Right? And so when you do them, they create agitation in the mind. That's why people call them adharmic. That's why it's there in the Vedas and in all of the religions. Don't do this and don't do that and don't do this and don't do that. Because if you do it, it creates problems for you. You can say, well, yeah, and it creates problems for others too. But it will always create a problem for you. It clutters up the mind. You know? And so you learn this from your own experience. So you gain a value for always trying to do what is dharmic, because you get such a peace from it. That's why that book, you know, Value of Values at Swamiji, is such a good book. You have that book. It's a beautiful book. Because we don't have a value for the values, you know. All of these values, the dharmas, you have to understand what do you get out of it? If you understand what you get out of it, then that becomes strong. Otherwise, you know, I can be dharmic, but if I do this, then I will get this thing that will make me happy. Mm. I'd rather be happy than do dharma, unless I know that the dharma actually gives me a greater happiness, a greater peace. Then I'll choose the dharma. Yeah, it's a simple thing, but we have to understand that all these things are really simple once they're understood. But if they're not understood, then you're just kind of blindly going after what you believe will make you happy, and sometimes that requires knocking off somebody. Can't resist.
It's like a saint novel. Like, yeah. A saint novel, huh?
Yeah.
Still more verses left in this contemplation chapter?
Yeah.
Oh, good.